does democracy look like?
Who should decide
your
that?
Own
the inventory of ideas.
Fairness for everybody.
From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's Democracy, a short history of a big idea, a special series from To the Best of Our Knowledge.
Ideas matter.
I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, writing democracy. Some people put their bodies on the line for democracy. Some pick up weapons, and some put pen to paper. Writers who use their gifts to speak truth to power have a special place in the annals of literature. We revere them for their conscience and their courage. Today, some of the world's most celebrated writers talk with us about the literature of democracy. Also, the poet in blue jeans, the dissident playwright who inspired the Velvet Revolution that overthrew the Soviet Union, former Czech President Václav Havel, on the role of the artist in an emerging democracy.
To simply tell the truth.
An ideal.
Public conversation.
Closer to the people.
But first, Mario Vargas Llosa is one of the godfathers of Latin American fiction. He won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2010. He also once ran for president of his native country, Peru. Politics and literature are the driving forces of his life, and they often come together. For instance, one of his most recent novels is The Feast of the Goat, the story of Rafael Trujillo, the infamous dictator of the Dominican Republic. Vargas Llosa tells Steve Paulson why he found the subject so compelling and what became of his own political ambitions.
You know that when I was young, all over Latin America there were military dictatorships, but probably the most emblematic dictatorship of the times was Trujillo's, was that of the Dominican Republic, because besides the brutality, the cruelty which is common to authoritarian regimes, in Trujillo there was also this theatricality, these extravagances because of his personality, and that gave me the idea of the novel.
Can you give me some sense of the theatricality, how he ruled, and how he managed to rule not just by threatening to torture his opponents, but how he commanded some kind of loyalty on a psychological level as well?
Oh, yes, without any doubt. Well, this is probably the saddest aspect of many dictators, you know, that they are, at least for a while, quite popular. And I think he was popular probably until the last 2 or 3 years of his government.
Now, one of the mysteries of a dictator like Trujillo is how he managed to stay in power for so long, where his popularity came from. And in your novel, you make it clear that loyalty was valued above all other qualities. In fact, some of his soldiers were given tests to prove their loyalty. They might be asked to give up the woman they want to marry, or in some cases, to kill a political opponent, just sheerly to show that they are loyal to Trujillo.
That's right. That gives an idea of the extremes of corruption that the regime produced. I think at the beginning, it was possible to resist Trujillo. But then, when the regime is very well established, has all the power to persuade or terrify, resistance become more and more weak. And this accumulation of power, you know, I think transformed the dictator in a kind of monster. I wanted very much in my novel, you know, to describe this process in which a whole society, in a way, in spite of being a victim, it's also an accomplice.
So you're saying that professionals, whether they're doctors or lawyers, intellectuals, also wanted to show their loyalty to Trujillo, and that was the way to become successful in that country.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know that Trujillo praised himself, saying that he had called the best minds of the Dominican Republic to work with him, you know. And in a way, this was true, you know, because if you were called, it was practically impossible to say no, to take a distance because of the brutality of the regime. So many talented people, professionals, intellectuals, were appointed members of the government, and they couldn't say no, you know, because their freedom and even their lives were at risk if they didn't collaborate, you know.
Now, we've been talking about the source of Trujillo's mystique, and part of it was his machismo, and he bragged about his sexual prowess until right up until the time he was killed, and he would talk openly about all the affairs he was having with the wives of some of his closest aides.
Well, this is a very, you know, sinister aspect, I think, of Trujillo's personality. Of course, he was very sexual, you know, his country, Latin America, a very machista region, and so women were, let's say, privileged victims of the regime because you had dictatorship and machismo fuse, you know. But in his case, I think there was this other aspect which is really very, very dark, very twisted. He used sex as an instrument to humiliate people and also to make his collaborators passed a test, you know. He went to bed with women, wives of his ministers, and one got the impression that he did this because it was a way to prove, you know, the loyalty, the spirit of sacrifice of his collaborators. That it was, in a machista country, of course, it was the maximum sacrifice to accept, you know, this kind of humiliation. And he did it, well, in a way, systematically, you know.
Can you tell me about the assassination of Trujillo in 1961? How did it happen?
Well, it was a group, you know, of people. Some of them had been part of the regime. Some had been humiliated and offended by Trujillo and became very angry. But some of them not. And some of them were people who were horrified with what was happening in the country. One of them, for example, was a very committed Catholic, you know, and he was pushed to participate in this conspiracy for, let's say, moral and religious reasons. And they decided to kill him because they were convinced that the only way in which the Dominican Republic could move towards a democratic system was killing Trujillo. That as far as Trujillo was there, there was no way for a peaceful evolution, you know, toward democracy.
Well, as you were investigating this history, were you sympathetic to the assassins? Did that seem like the only way to save the country, to kill the dictator?
Well, you know, I am, of course, against assassination as a political instrument. But I think there are some very, you know, special cases in history in which, you know, what is called by St. Augustine, you know, tyrannicide is justifiable. If Hitler would have been killed during this conspiracy, probably millions of deaths would have been avoided. And I suppose in the case of the Dominican Republic, it was like that, you know. If Trujillo remained in power, the killings, the tortures, the disappearances, and all this violence against the Trujillo society would have continued. So in this sense, probably they were right, you know.
I have to ask you about your own political experiences because, of course, you have immersed yourself in it. You ran for president in Peru in 1990. You lost to Fujimori, the man who later proved to be a demagogue who abolished much of the democratic government of Peru. Did that experience have anything to do with this decision to write this novel about Trujillo?
No, I don't. Well, not consciously, at least, you know. I participated, you know, in politics, I think for the wrong reasons, you know, not for political reasons, but, well, I would say for moral reasons, civic reasons. I suppose I was wrong to doing this because be a successful politician, I think you need to got the appetite and also the aptitude, you know, and it was not my case, you know. Mm. But I don't regret it because even if I failed and it was, well, in a very hard experience, it was very instructive. I learned, you know, a lot about politics and about myself and about my country. And of course, I suppose I have used all this write in this novel in which politics is, well, so important.
Do you see any inherent conflict between working in politics, being a politician, and writing literature?
Very much. I think probably these two activities are incompatible, one with the other. Huh? I think both require, you know, total commitment. That's one thing that I learned during those years in which I was a candidate. If you want to be a writer, you cannot be, you know, a professional politician.
Why is that? Is it because writers have to be free to say whatever they want, to voice any criticisms, whereas politicians have to be so careful about what they say?
And I think you have to got some perspective, you know, this perspective that gives you independence, you know, to be free thinker and a free writer and to abandon yourself to your fantasies. And if you are a politician with a responsibility, you cannot do that, even if you try. You know, that's why many intellectuals and some, well, very respectable intellectuals, let's say Vaclav Havel, for example, I think is a very interesting case. He was a very good writer, a very good playwright. But when he became president of his country, I think the writer disappeared completely, you know. I think it was a great sacrifice, probably very useful for Czechia, you know. He has contributed very much to the democratization of the country, but it was the sacrifice of his literary vocation.
Mario Vargas Llosa won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2010. His novel about Rafael Trujillo, the infamous dictator of the Dominican Republic, is called The Feast of the Goat. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Another man who had trouble choosing between his career as a writer and as a politician is the playwright Václav Havel. He was known first as the romantic poet in blue jeans, the dissident Czech playwright who was thrown in jail for his anti-communist plays. Later, he emerged to inspire the so-called Velvet Revolution that overthrew the Soviet Union. Havel was elected president of the Czech Republic and served from 1993 to 2003. Near the end of his time in office, Steve Paulson spoke with him about the role of writers and artists in a democracy.
Mr. President, it's hard for Americans to understand how important artists and poets and playwrights can be to the political and moral life of a country. Can you give me some sense of how important they have been to the Czech people?
Mohl byste říct něco k tomu, jaký význam mají takovéto osobnosti pro český národ?
Měli v naší moderní historii možná od století 18.
Indeed, in our modern history, from the 18th century onward, they indeed possessed heightened importance. Artists were settled with certain political or societal expectations and in a situation when the nation found itself under somebody else's rule. And therefore, the nation projected the absence of this kind of representation into the intellectual circles. And it seems to me that this era, which we could witness in most Central and Eastern European countries, although it had different coloring from case to case, is now coming to an end because with the advancement of democratic institutions and with a new generation of professional politicians growing up, the voice of the artists or the poets no longer possesses the somewhat unnatural urgency that it used to have as a response to those former expectations.
Let me ask a more personal question. Why did the communist leaders consider you and other artists so threatening after 1968?
Indeed, I have pondered upon this question quite extensively and have even written some essays about that. The role of people such as Solzhenitsyn in Russia or others has really been incredible. Why should somebody who controlled the police, the army, the economy, all the media of the nation be afraid of a lonely man who has nothing except a typewriter? And whenever I have thought about that, I have always concluded that the more totalitarian a regime is, the stronger is the radioactive force of free speech, if free expression is vouched for personally, and if people are willing to take personal risks on its behalf. All of a sudden, free speech, backed up by this personal commitment, proves capable of disrupting all those huge structures of power. This is certainly a very special kind of experience, and numerous cases in point in the former communist countries can corroborate that.
Mr. President, I've talked with writers from South Africa who are actually nostalgic for the bad old days of apartheid when they were dodging the police and passing around manuscripts underground. And for a writer, it must be kind of thrilling to know that you really matter. You are the conscience of your country. And I'm wondering if you miss anything about those old days.
It's true that in those times certain things were easier in a situation when you are driven into a ghetto. Philosopher Patočka called this a community of the shaken ones, perhaps. And that kind of a community was marked by a great measure of mutual solidarity when we all had to help one another. And from that point of view, certain things were better than they have been in a free environment. But I am very careful about yielding to perhaps inclination to indulge in a nostalgia for the old days, because it was clearly a bad time for the country, a bad time for its population, at a time that devastated the nation's soul, its economy, the country's landscape, etc. So whenever I should feel the temptation to indulge in some nostalgic memories for the times when we were all brothers helping each other instead of confronting each other, perhaps, from different political parties, I always repudiate that kind of thought speedily.
Václav Havel was president of the Czech Republic from 1993 to 2003. Steve Paulson spoke with him near the end of his last term. Music from the Czech rock band The Plastic People of the Universe. The group was founded in 1968, after the Prague Spring, but was later banned and its members imprisoned. Their arrest inspired Václav Havel and others to write the Human Rights Manifesto called Charter 77. Want to hear more interviews on democracy? Visit our new website at ttbook.org, now featuring 20 years of interviews available to stream, download, and share. For to the best of our knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Writing Democracy, is part of our special series, Democracy, A Short History of a Big Idea, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin System eCampus, providing access to online degree programs and certificates offered by the 26 campuses of the UW system. Information is at ecampus.wisconsin.edu.
We're talking about writing democracy in this hour. In a few minutes, Nobel Prize winner V.S. Naipaul. But first, the political writer as blogger. Some of the largest demonstrations in American history took place just a few blocks from our studios in downtown Madison, Wisconsin. Republican Governor Scott Walker had proposed cutting pensions and benefits for thousands of public employees. For days, hundreds of thousands of peaceful protesters occupied the state capitol. They ate there, they slept there, and they wrote there. Among them was sleep-in activist and blogger Christy Taylor.
Day 6, 10:15 p.m. I leave my possessions in a corner while I explore. It feels safe. Some of these people are already my friends, and the rest might as well be. Volunteer marshals patrol the building in blaze yellow vests, keeping order so the police don't have to. This is no lawless college party. Instead, it's a highly organized community. Volunteers have established food stations where you can help yourself to Ian's pizza, granola bars, and fruit. A library of union reading material. A first aid station with lozenges for shouted out throats. A family space, complete with toys and volunteer daycare. Several signs declare our principles. The first, that the Capitol is our house, and we should keep it clean out of respect. Day 6, 10:30 p.m. I watch several protesters clean the first floor of the rotunda. They have no mops. They have no brooms. Instead, they kneel with rags for at least 20 minutes. The marble floor never looked that dirty, but their rags come away black. I'm stunned. There they are, tenderly scrubbing the epicenter of our very own historic populist movement. A man says, "I wish Fox News would report on this." I am surrounded by civics lessons. And there's fun. I see people reading and playing chess. I pass drum circles, salsa lessons, meditation circles, and a three-piece folk band playing "This Land Is Your Land." There is no dearth of laughter. I see the police, who watch the building's entrances, talk and joke with the visitors. Many of them also disagree with Walker's bill, and it shows. We find moments to thank them for the overtime they're working, for their politeness and helpfulness. Day 6, 11:15 p.m. A warier undercurrent now. A woman hands out the phone number for the ACLU and tells us to take a workshop on nonviolent resistance. I hear several conflicting rumors about when the governor might order us kicked out. I will learn that this is commonplace. Day 6, 12 a.m. Tired at last. The spot I've staked out has an unobstructed view of the mural of Justice, who watches from the dome. I have a sleeping bag, a pillow, and a paper-thin yoga mat. The lights are still fully on. The big marble house hums with hundreds of quiet conversations. Eventually I fall asleep, staring at Justice's face. Day 7, 6 a.m. I wake disoriented, cold, and without a sense that I really slept. It's finally quiet in our house. Just a few footsteps and the strange hum of hundreds of people breathing in an echo chamber. A man tells me that it won't start to get loud again until about 8. A member of the drum circle sleeps 5 feet from me, snoring. In one of the women's restrooms, I change into my clothes and brush my teeth, loaning toothpaste to another bleary-eyed woman. It's still dark when I leave to go to my 9-to-5 job. I turn to look back at the glowing white of the Wisconsin State Capitol. I'll never look at it the same way again. Once, it was alien and intimidating. Now, I feel far closer to it and the power that it represents. I feel, in both my bones and my slightly aching back, the truth of the matter. This is our house. Day 7, 8 p.m. I'm back. Tired all day. I didn't get much done at work. And I long for a quiet night home with my cat and my mattress. But the loud rattle of the Capitol beckons. I enter to the sound of drums. The din is comforting. Day 7, 1 a.m. It is a night of even more terrible sleep than the last. I wish it was dark. I wish I had earplugs. I miss my cat. I wake again at 3, at 4, at 5. Day 8, 7 a.m. I reset my alarm 3 times before I finally pull myself awake. I don't stop to brush my teeth. I just pull on jeans and head to work in the morning hush. I'm exhausted and less hopeful. Day 10, 9:30 p.m. I reclaim the corner overlooked by Justice. Large TV monitors show us the assembly on its second straight night of debating the bill. But since everyone is still chanting, I can barely hear it. Lacking internet or a smartphone, I feel cut off from events that are happening less than 100 feet away. Day 10, 10:30 p.m. I get in line for the assembly viewing galleries. High on the fourth floor, I look down on the crowd, which roars in the direction of the chamber. Kill the bill. While they are blocked by police tape from getting near, I'm about to cross the border into the heart of it all. I'm in my pajamas, and I have no shoes on. It is thrilling. Day 10, 11 p.m. Everyone watching is riveted. At 11 o'clock on a Thursday night, there are more than 100 people with their eyes on the proceedings of their state government. It's like we've been breathing the fumes of civic engagement as we sleep. When this fight finishes, for good or for ill, Wisconsin will be richer in people who understand what the Constitution owes them and who care. Day 10, 12:30 a.m. I can't keep my eyes open. I creep away to sleep. The debate from the assembly floor echoes through speakers. I fall asleep to the sound of Democrat Therese Brousseau speaking passionately about the value of the American middle class. This is the warmest, cold, hard floor I've slept on.
Christy Taylor is a writer and blogger living in Madison, Wisconsin.
Willie was living in the college as in a daze. The learning he was being given was like the food he was eating, without savor. The two were inseparable in his mind.
Novelist V.S. Naipaul.
And just as he ate without pleasure, so with a kind of blindness, he did what the lecturers and tutors asked of him, read the books and articles and did the essays. He was unanchored, with no idea of what lay ahead. At the college, he had to relearn everything that he knew. He had to learn how to eat in public. He had to learn how to greet people and how, having greeted them, not to greet them all over again in a public place 10 or 15 minutes later. Gradually, learning the quaint rules of his college, with the churchy Victorian buildings pretending to be older than they were, Willie began to see in a new way the rules he'd left behind at home. He began to see, and it was upsetting at first, that the old rules were themselves a kind of make-believe, self-imposed. And one day, towards the end of his second term, he saw with great clarity that the old rules no longer bound him.
That's V.S. Naipaul reading from his novel Half a Life. Naipaul won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2001. A Trinidadian British citizen, he's known for his novels focusing on the legacy of the British Empire's colonialism. Among them, the modern classic called A Bend in the River. Steve Paulson talks with him.
You have often been described as a post-colonial writer because many of your books deal with what happens to a country once the imperial power has packed up and gone, once the empire has collapsed.
Yes, yes.
Do you see
yes.
yourself as a post-colonial writer?
Well, what I think I do, I would say I wrote about what happened after the dissolution of empires. So, probably it means the same thing, but post-colonial has a kind of academic, jargony ring which I resist. Probably it's not right of me to do so, but there we are. It's done.
Does it bother you at all that your critics often consider you too harsh when you write about third world countries?
I think they're talking nonsense and rubbish. I pay no attention to them. Because they seldom can tell me where I went wrong. If you're writing about emerging societies, you have to write about people who are losing their way, often losing their way. You have to. And the thing is that the heroes of these societies change with years. I would have looked an awful fool if in 1960 I had taken various colonial leaders as ideals. It would have been, you know, my work would have been not read. We wouldn't be talking about it now.
Because I think the argument on the other side is that you don't, well, you don't come down hard enough on the old colonial powers, and I suppose
It's a foolish thing to say, because the world knows about empires, and there's a whole body of thing about imperialism, and I don't wish to join the chorus.
You've also traveled throughout the Islamic world, and you've written about Islamic fundamentalists. Were you completely surprised by what happened on September 11th?
I was astonished, and I cannot enter the mind of those people. I cannot enter the nihilistic attitude to the world of those people. Of course, I know that the nihilism exists. I can see that this fundamentalism lead to that nihilistic attitude, this hatred of humanity, this hatred of the world. And the terrible thing is that the people who wish to destroy the world have nothing to put in its place. This is what I mean by nihilism.
So you would say the fundamentalism in Islam is fundamentally different than the kind of fundamentalism we might see among Jews or Christians, that there's a more strident tone to Islamic fundamentalists.
You know, I have to be careful because I don't know. I haven't studied the Jews. I haven't studied Judaism. And Christian fundamentalism here is such a special growth. And so, as it were, unrelated to the history of Christianity. Christianity in its beginnings, extraordinary, mysterious faith, very hard to fathom. So the fundamentalism, as people call it, of Christians here, where they exist, is quite different from the call in an Islamic country for people to revert to the origins, to go back to the beginning. No one here can make that call because no one here truly understands or appreciates early Christianity. There is a difference. Fundamentalism here, I suppose, just means following the Bible literally and doing certain things. But the other thing to remember about that, it is set within a set of laws, a constitution, places of learning. It has all kinds of institutions around it, whereas Islamic fundamentalism wouldn't have these institutions. And when they try to set them up, it depends on the will or the fancy of the ruler, and it leads to tyrannies like the Taliban.
V.S. Naipaul won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2001. His most noted work is the novel A Bend in the River. Steve Paulson spoke with him. You'll find dozens of interviews with political writers on our new website at ttbook.org, now featuring 20 years of interviews available to stream, download, and share. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Writing Democracy, is part of our special series, Democracy, A Short History of a Big Idea, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. In 2008, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie won one of the 25 coveted MacArthur Genius Grants. Her second novel, called Half of a Yellow Sun, won the 2007 Orange Prize for Fiction. It's the story of two sisters who drift apart in 1960s Nigeria during a period of civil violence centered around the creation of the new nation, Biafra. Here's Adichie with a reading about a houseboy named Ugwu.
Master was a little crazy. He had spent too many years reading books overseas, talked to himself in his office, did not always return greetings, and had too much hair. Ugwu's auntie said this in a low voice as they walked on the path, But he's a good man, she added, and as long as you walk well, you'll eat well. You will even eat meat every day. She stopped to spit. The saliva left her mouth with a sucking sound and landed on the grass. Ugwu did not believe that anybody, not even this master he was going to live with, ate meat every day. He did not disagree with his auntie, though, because he was too choked with expectation, too busy imagining his new life away from the village. I told Master you will learn everything fast. Osiso, osiso, his auntie said. Ugwu nodded attentively, although she had already told him this many times, as often as she told him the story of how his good fortune came about. While she was sweeping the corridor in the mathematics department a week ago, she heard Master say that he needed a houseboy to do his cleaning, and she immediately said she could help, speaking before his typist or his office messenger could offer to bring someone. I will learn fast, auntie, Ugwu said.
Tell us something about when this novel takes place.
The book starts actually in the early 60s, before the Civil War, and so it was shortly after independence in Nigeria, and in many ways a period of much optimism when people felt that Africa was on its way to becoming a great world power. And it's interesting, there were actually a lot of Americans at the university town of Soka where the book is set, because a lot of them were in the Peace Corps and were teaching there. And also the university had some sort of affiliation with Michigan State. And so there were people who had come from Michigan State and spent time there teaching. But we slowly sort of watch things change as the years pass. And it turns out that, you know, the optimism was
misplaced.
Yes.
Yeah. This is, I get the feeling, a very personal story for you, although clearly before your time.
I was born 7 years after the war ended. The war started in 1967 and ended in 1970. And so, I didn't experience it personally, but my family did. And in some ways, I've always felt that it's also my story, that it's my history, that I inherited what happened to my family. Both my grandfathers died in the war. My relatives also died. My parents lost everything they owned. And so in many ways, this book is a collection of stories from people who actually experienced these things, just that I fictionalized things a bit. But it's mostly my way of paying tribute to that time and my way of refusing to forget.
For the thousands who have forgotten what happened in Nigeria in the 1960s, what are the bare facts?
The bare facts, in 1966, it's so difficult to make it short, and I will. Biafra was the part in eastern Nigeria where the Igbo people live. The Igbo people, however, are people who sort of spread out across Nigeria. And in the north, there was a massacre of Igbo people for political reasons. And they then decided to secede and form their own country and call it Biafra. And the rest of Nigeria said, no, we won't let you secede. And I think the primary reason was because the oil, which had only recently been discovered in Nigeria, happened to be within the borders of this state that wanted to become independent. And so the war started, one side fighting to be independent, the other side fighting to keep them in Nigeria. And in 1970, it ended with Biafra losing and going back to being part of Nigeria. And I think the image that most people have of Biafra is that of the starving children, because that's the image that was broadcast all over the world, and people were asked to save Biafra and donate money because children were dying.
As you say, it is almost impossible to simplify the story, which is why Half of a Yellow Sun is such an important retelling of it. It's the people who make those stories. There was the whole issue of colonialism, which was not that far in the past at the beginning of this story or at the beginning of the Civil War.
Oh, absolutely. Nigeria had only been independent since 1960. The war started 6 years later. And I mean, clearly, I think it's impossible to talk about that period of our history or even to talk about now, present day Nigeria, without engaging with the legacy of colonialism. The fact that the country itself was created by the British. People were lumped together and told that you're now one country, now live with it.
Being defined by the outside doesn't make it any easier for people to believe it, does it?
No, it doesn't. I mean, I think in some ways that for one to believe in a nation, I think people have to collectively imagine that nation into being. And when you haven't been given the chance to, it would cause problems anyway.
What caused it to fail? Was it simply that the rest of Nigeria didn't want it?
I think that it was many things. I think that the fact that Nigeria had a lot of international support, that Britain supported Nigeria, And also that the US supported Nigeria in the sort of in the way that it did nothing about Biafra, and in the way that it said, you know, it's under British sphere of control, so we'll just go along with the British. And so I think international support, that lots of countries just refused to recognize Biafra. I also think that internally Biafra had problems, that there were trust issues between the head of Biafra and other people. So I think it's complex. But I sometimes wonder whether if Nigeria hadn't had the kind of support it had. I mean, Biafra didn't have any, had very little arms. And so you had people fighting with knives, fighting the other side that had machine guns. And so, you know, it's, but of course, it's always very easy in retrospect to sort of say, well, this is why it didn't happen. I don't know. I guess, who knows?
You talk about this being part of a movement to get this time talked about again. Is that what has happened within your family? Do you hear more now? Do you get more stories because of the stories you've told?
Yes, absolutely, yes. I mean, I started when I was working on this book, and I've been working on it for, oh, good God, I don't know, since I was 10. I've been thinking about this book. And I constantly ask questions of my parents, my relatives. But now that this book has come out and that it's been read in Nigeria, I find that people volunteer stories much more easily now.
What kind of stories do they tell you now?
Little stories, the kinds that I love the most. My aunt, for example, telling me what she would do to the dried egg yolk she got from the Red Cross to make it last longer. Apparently, she would sort of mix it with water and with some palm oil and then put, you know, things of that sort. And also, in some ways, strange contemporary stories. Another aunt, who's a farmer in my ancestral hometown, said that she dug up bullets recently in her farm. So the bullets from the war, and she was sort of tilling the soil and she dug them up. And, you know, for me, that was, I was thinking this is a metaphor and it must be significant. I'm not sure. I mean, sort of all the layers of meaning to this.
How much do you think what happened in the 1960s defines what Nigeria is today?
You know, that period, I mean, I didn't learn anything about this war when I was in school in Nigeria. So it's a part of our history that we don't talk about, much as many countries don't talk about, you know, histories that they're ashamed of. And I think because of that, there's so much that's unresolved. And I think there's a lot of resentment still in eastern Nigeria among people who feel that they were cheated, the war ended, and somehow we're all supposed to pretend that nothing happened, while jobs were lost, property was taken over by the government, and there's just so much that still hasn't been talked about. So I think it's still important today, and I'm hoping that this book actually would get us talking about it. And I think it is happening, particularly for Nigerians in my generation, that now we're starting to ask questions about, you know, about a recent history.
That's Nigerian novelist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Her most noted novel is called Half of a Yellow Sun. Who's the best model of the politically engaged writer? Journalist Christopher Hitchens nominates George Orwell, author of Animal Farm in 1984. In his book, Why Orwell Matters, Hitchens says that Orwell got it right about imperialism, fascism, and communism. Hitchens tells Steve Paulson that Orwell opposed all of them at a time when most intellectuals ignored the contradictions of the left.
When we look back on the century we've just escaped from or survived, the 20th century, the three great questions, great confrontations in that century were, should the rest of the world be ruled by white people? Should imperialism or will imperialism be considered civilization? What to do about the threat of National Socialism, Fascism, Nazism? You know, the challenge to civilization from the extreme right. And what to do about the illusion that Soviet communism is the answer? Well, only George Orwell, it seems to me, answered all those three questions correctly.
By correctly, you mean Orwell was opposed to communism, fascism, and imperialism.
He was very strongly against all three, and he was against them, I think, for the right reasons and in the right way. More people ought to have been able to say this, but it's surprising how few, when you look back, can. Hemingway, H.G. Wells, George Bernard Shaw, lots of very well-known and quite brave people, quite decent people at the time, didn't manage to hold all those three thoughts in their minds at once, contradicted themselves, often shamefully.
You know, it's ironic that Orwell was so anti-imperialist when his father benefited so much from it. He even followed his father as a British policeman in Burma, but he soon left. Why?
He was opposed to the whole policy of imperialism. He didn't like it. But I think he feared in himself that if he stayed, he would become disfigured and depraved by it. And I think it's very obvious from both the tone of his first novel, Burmese Days, a much underrated novel. It anticipates all of the sweltering, horrible world of Graham Greene and disillusionment and sexual failure and all of that, as well as racism and the dilemmas that will occur to any moral person in such a position. He thought that there was something truly repellent about the treatment of the Burmese, and it wasn't just that their labour power and their resources were being taken away by the British, who kept Burma underdeveloped. It was that there was a sexual element of cruelty in the treatment of the Burmese while this was going on.
But what do you mean a sexual element?
I'll put it like this. If you were a Burmese or Indian or Asian man, and you were the most educated possible, you'd been to 10 universities and you were twice as well educated as any of the British rulers of your country, you still wouldn't be allowed into membership of the English club in the town. But if you were a Burmese woman of no culture at all, you could be admitted to the back door of any Englishman's bungalow at any hour of the day or night, usually for pay. Flory, the policeman, who's the anti-hero of Orwell's novel, at one point, quite shockingly, very casually, lets it fall that he's bought his Burmese mistress, who basically has a slave. The master-slave relationship interested Orwell very much. It fascinated him, and it repelled him. He was afraid, I think, of the temptations it had for someone like himself, who was, on the whole, lonely, didn't think he was attractive to women. I don't know, and he never told anyone why he quit, but I believe very strongly that that's why. He thought, if I stay, I'll become a monster with this system and these temptations, these opportunities. He certainly makes all through his novels, especially in 1984, the climactic one, a very great use of his knowledge of the sadomasochistic element that's involved in what Nietzsche called the master-slave relationship. The whole idea of power is involved with cruelty. And that is not a lesson that we can say that we left behind with the 20th century.
So here was Orwell, one of the great critics of the British Empire, a man of the left, and then he turned against communism. How did that happen?
Well, it happened to him precisely because of his big volunteer effort for the left. I mean, he was one of the first people to volunteer for the Spanish Civil War, to decide that really, if you meant what you said, you had to use your own body and put it in the way and try and physically block the advance of fascism in Europe. He went on his own. And as a result, he joined a random workers' militia in Barcelona and took a particular interest in the Catalonian front and the Catalonian struggle. And this was actually a militia run by a group of Marxists in Spain who were very, very anti-Stalin. So by pure chance, really, he was not in the main stream of the left attitude towards the Spanish Civil War or the left tactic towards it, and was able to see with his own eyes something that seemed incredible if you took the standard view of the Civil War as a left-right issue, that the Communist Party's main interest was in putting down the revolutionary element in Catalonia. So he saw something coming that was later to happen in a lot of European countries. At the time, it seemed to people impossible to keep, you know, more than one thought in their heads at once. I mean, either you're for the Republic or you're for fascism. We don't want to hear all this complicated business about what's happening. There's a civil war within the civil war, if you will. And so he wrote a book saying, well, how it looks to me is as if Stalinism is actually trying to destroy the Spanish Republic and sabotage the anti-fascist cause. And I'm very worried that this truth will never become known, but I feel I have to write a book about it. The book is called Homage to Catalonia. Sold, I don't know, probably about 500 copies in his lifetime. Most publishers wouldn't take it. Most magazines wouldn't review it, especially on the liberal left.
Well, I'm sure it was heresy for him to say these things.
It was extreme heresy, and he never expected that it wouldn't have any impact at all. And in his lifetime, it did not. It wasn't published in the United States until the 50s. But it's now one of the most celebrated books of war reportage and truth-telling ever to be penned. I don't think I've ever been in a war zone. I've been, you know, places like Bosnia, Afghanistan and Kashmir and Pakistan last year, where among not just the older but the younger war correspondents, the ones who are interested in finding out what's really going on, it isn't that book that's partly motivated them to be there in the first place. It's extraordinarily impressive.
Now, one thing that's always puzzled me about Orwell's career as a writer is he was a great journalist, a brilliant essayist, but he kind of struggled as a fiction writer for a while. And I guess the question is, why did he want to write novels?
There was a need to be able to discuss things in the third person, which he wasn't able to do in his nonfiction. In other words, he wouldn't have written about himself as he writes about Flory. He wouldn't have said he himself felt this sexual and racial frenzy when he was in Burma, that he was divided in mind between whether he loathed the non-white or loved them and was on their side, was divided in mind as to whether or not he could take advantage of the availability of slave women. I don't think he could have written that in his own voice.
You're really saying that he needed art to be able to express the ambiguity?
Not so much with Animal Farm, which I'm not a great fan of, but with 1984, he managed to throw into the action of a novel everything he'd ever learned from his own life and travels and struggles and reading, and produce something that now, of course, it's taught to school children and it's, you know, set text and we're not scared of Stalin anymore or Hitler, this kind of thing. But when the first readers of that book at the publishing house and elsewhere opened it, it filled them with a sensation of physical fear. I mean, they were terrified by what he was talking about. So it's a wonderful fictional summa of a nonfiction career, if you will.
I want to back up for a moment to the novel that you said you're not that big a fan of, Animal Farm, but which Orwell said of that book, it's the first book in which I tried with full consciousness of what I was doing to fuse political purpose and artistic purpose into one whole. You obviously think he did not succeed.
It's a very touching and skillful and admirable attainment in the Swiftian style of doing fable or allegory, and it charms people who don't really know what the history behind it is, who don't know of what it is in allegory, and so it is an artistic success in some ways. But I'm a bit tough-minded about this kind of thing. If you're going to do an allegory using animals or any other critters, humans perhaps, of the history of the Bolshevik Revolution, you have to have three figures in it. You have to have Stalin, you have to have Lenin, you have to have Trotsky. There is no Lenin in Animal Farm. There's only Stalin. And the same, by the way, is true of 1984. There's no Lenin there. There's only a Stalin, Big Brother, in the latter case, and Napoleon in the first. There's a Trotsky in each, Snowball and Goldstein. This represents a failure on his part to make up his mind about the relationship between Lenin and Stalin. But it's such a glaring omission that until I wrote this book, I hadn't noticed it, and nor had anyone else. I've never read a discussion of either novel that points this out. It's Stalin versus Trotsky. The Lenin period is, so to speak, concertinaed out of existence. Now, I don't know why that is, but he can't have been unaware of it.
Writer and journalist Christopher Hitchens on his book Why Orwell Matters. Steve Paulson spoke with him. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour is called Writing Democracy. It's part of our special series, Democracy, A Short History of a Big Idea, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our series was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Anne Strainchamps, and Doug Gordon. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Steve Mullen at Walk West Productions wrote the theme music. For more information about the series, visit our new website at ttbook.org, now featuring 20 years of interviews available to stream, download, and share.
PRI, Public Radio International.